طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. Policing in America is under intense scrutiny in the wake of continuing demonstrations and nonviolent displays of rage over the shooting of unarmed black people. The restructuring of policing and our understanding of safety and security are at the heart of that scrutiny. The militarized, discriminatory practice of policing, which is geared to control society, has not and will not provide security and safety for everyone in that society. How did we get this warped concept of safety and security? And whom does it serve? We know whom it does not serve, and we must find a way forward to create a just, safe, secure society for everyone. How did we get where we are, and who is fueling this militarized, discriminatory policing of America? Jeff Halper has meticulously researched this issue, and in particular, the role Israel is playing in arming the security state. His book, The War Against the People, is a must-read and serves as the basis for an article he recently wrote on the intersection of policing in America and Israel. We lead this morning with a reading of Halper's recent article we found in Mondo Weiss. Jeff Halper is an American-born anthropologist, author, professor, and activist who has lived in Israel since 1973. I will now quote from his recent offering. A lot of attention has been directed recently at the training American police receive from Israel. It's extensive and pervasive. The point, however, is not that Israel has made U.S. police more violent. They were violent and repressive a century or more before Israel was even established. It isn't even that Israel has helped militarize the U.S. police. It has, of course, but in response to fundamental shifts in the American political and economic scene. The Israelization of the American police begins in the wake of 9/11, but three key developments in the U.S. explain why. First, by 9/11, the debilitating effects of neoliberalism, starting in the Reagan administration but already creating huge social and income disparities in the Bush and Clinton years. They began calling for law and order, domestic wars on drugs, on crime, on radicals, and a need to control and pacify an ever-growing precariat, underemployed, underpaid middle-class people, the working poor, and the largely racialized actual poor. Capitalism's enforcers are the police. Second, by 9/11, the UN had lost the Soviet Union and communism as an external, internal threat that could be exploited to justify repressive anti-democratic policies at home. While the threat of terrorists has become a minor issue in Clinton's time, it was not tied strongly to the domestic arena. That tie-in, the third source of police Israelization, came with 9/11. The Patriot Act, which until today fundamentally curtails American civil rights and due process, was enacted less than 2 months later. Clearly, it was in the drawer waiting for its opportunity. And again, policing becomes the vehicle for a wholly new paramilitary task, homeland security. That was the backdrop. It was not an Israeli creation, but Israel has been a security state since its founding in 1948. I would even put its roots as a highly militarized society back to the start of the 20th century. It has been over the past 125 years of settler colonialism that the Israeli security state emerged. Israel's ongoing war against the internal, external Palestinian people, with all the inherent insecurity and preoccupation with security that engenders, placed it just where post-9/11 America wanted it to be. Israel provided the U.S., and particularly the U.S. police and security agencies, with ready-made policies, doctrines, paramilitary structures, and weaponry they lacked but needed in order to construct an American security state. Israel provided the model and the hardware. But what was the problem? Why couldn't the U.S. just enact the policies, create the structure, and produce the weapons conducive to a security state, especially now that it has the homeland security justification? The answer is akin to the notion of colorblindness. In The New Jim Crow, Michelle Alexander describes the dilemma of enforcing police policies of racial repression at a time, from the 1960s and 70s, when outright expressions of racism were no longer acceptable. She documents how the war on drugs co-opted the racial agenda, but under the rubric of fighting drugs, which few could argue with. The U.S. had the same problem in its transition to the security state. How could it subordinate civil liberties in favor of policing while retaining its image as a democracy? Specifically, the problem facing the U.S. in empowering its police to engage in homeland security was the wall erected by the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878. Like similar laws and regulations in other European states, the Posse Act strictly separates domestic law enforcement, internal security, from the deployment of the military, external security. This doesn't mean that the military cannot be deployed domestically. The National Guard plays that role occasionally. But for the real military to be called out, as Trump tried to do in Washington, D.C., an obscure 1807 Insurrection Act had to be invoked, and the Pentagon refused. So even though U.S. companies have the capability of producing military weapons, the wall has placed constraints on them from developing military-style police arms. This opens a huge market for Israel, not only custom-tailoring military weapons for law enforcement, but for the civilian market as well. The Israeli weapons industry has opened a manufacturing plant in Middletown, Pennsylvania, where it produces, for example, a pistol-size Uzi submachine gun for police. That plant produces a wide variety of militarized weapons for law enforcement, including lines of Galil and Tavor assault rifles and a tactical rifle called the Zion 15. Israel is also the world's leader in drones, producing 60% of the global market. Drones are becoming staples of U.S. police departments, but here too the wall poses a challenge. Drones are commonly used for surveillance, but weaponized drones are still forbidden to U.S. police. A second source of Israeli militarization of U.S. police comes from the Israeli experience itself. Zionism, like U.S. Manifest Destiny, is a settler colonial movement, in that all colonized peoples resist their displacement and elimination. The settler community lives in a state of perpetual insecurity, of permanent emergency, in which every aspect of life is militarized. Much of the violence in American culture comes from the genocidal campaigns against the Native Americans. Andrew Jackson is Trump's favorite president. And many Westerns revolve precisely around the sheriffs and marshals, showing just how closely connected policing is to violent colonization. By the 1870s, however, the American settler regime had largely pacified the Native Americans. That made it possible to shift to a more civilian regime. The enactment of the 1878 Posse Act served to civilianize the police. In Israel, that never happened. The Palestinians remain a potent source of resistance to colonization, and therefore Israel is the only Western country not to separate civilian law enforcement from the military. On the contrary, by criminalizing Palestinian resistance as terrorism, Israel combines policing with the military. Thus, in Israel, the police are not separated from the military, but bonded with a variety of paramilitary units that connect the two. This is the kind of restructuring of U.S. police forces that Israel advocates. The Israeli police is far from being merely a civilian agency charged with maintaining law and order. It is a paramilitary organization operating under the Ministry of Internal Security, which is integrated into wider military and security agencies under a regime of permanent emergency. Israel views the majority of the country's population, the Palestinian citizens of Israel and the non-citizens of the occupied territory, plus other segments of Israeli society, from African asylum seekers to pro-Arab progressives and leftists, as the enemy. The majority stance of the Israel police is thus not primarily a civilian task, protecting a society as a whole, but one of counterinsurgency and counterterrorism. The Israeli police are very upfront about this. Their official website defines their role as prevention of acts of terror, dismantling of explosive devices, and deployment in terrorist incidents. Only them moving on to routine police matters such as maintaining law and order, fighting crime, and traffic control. Counterterrorism is the mentality, with great overlap between high-intensity policing and low-intensity warfare, is a common securocratic battle space. Former Shin Bet director and then Minister of Internal Security, Avi Dichter, speaking before 10,000 police officers attending the International Association of Chiefs of Police in Boston, used the term crime of terrorists to underscore the intimate connection between fighting criminals and fighting terrorists. Crime and terror are two sides of the same coin, he asserted. Israel's mythical reputation as the world's premier anti-terrorist power lends its great clout in Congress, in the Pentagon, in Homeland Security circles, and among the police. Israel's paramilitary police fit well with paramilitary tendencies already present in American police departments. Already in the mid-1960s, Philadelphia and L.A. established SWAT teams. SWAT meaning Special Weapons Attack Team, hardly a civilian concept. This begins with what Radley Balco calls the rise of the warrior cop. Today, 80% of police forces have SWAT teams. Let's take a brief look at how American police forces apply principles from Israel's manual on counterterrorism on American cities. Taking Israel's notion that intelligence is the key to prevention and interdiction, in the early 2000s, the NYPD established a secret demographic unit that sent undercover officers known as rakers to map the human terrain of targeted minority neighborhoods, modeled, according to an NYPD source, on how Israeli authorities operate in the West Bank. Informants known as mosque crawlers monitored sermons and mosque activities. A terrorist interdiction unit followed up on their leads, and yet another squad, the Special Services Unit, conducts undercover work, illegally in some cases, outside of New York City. In 2012, the NYPD even opened an Israeli office locating in the Sharon District Police Headquarters in Kfar Saba in order to cooperate on a daily basis with the Israel police. If a bomber blows himself up in Jerusalem, the NYPD rushes to the scene, said Michael Dzinski, an NYPD officer who served in Israel. I was there to ask the New York question, why was this location? Was there something unique that the bomber had done? Was there any pre-notification? Was there a security lapse? Dzinski subsequently co-authored a book, Terrorist Suicide Bombings, Attack Interdiction, Mitigation, and Response. And another example of how Israeli security practices enter into the American law. Kathy Lanier, chief of police of the Washington, D.C. police, who once stated, "No experience in my life has had more of an impact on doing my job than going to Israel, authorized checkpoints in the troubled Northeast D.C. neighborhood of Trinidad to monitor and control street violence and the illegal narcotics trade." War, of course, has long been an American political concept, especially in terms of racial relations. American policing became overtly militarized when Reagan declared the war on drugs. That, in turn, was ratcheted up by a real war by Bush Sr. In the early 1990s, he inaugurated a program allowing surplus military equipment, weapons, and tactical vehicles to be transferred to law enforcement for use in drug enforcement. The Clinton administration further militarized policing by passing the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994, authored by Joe Biden. This, Alexander argues, laid the legal infrastructure for America's racial caste system, since it resulted in the mass incarceration and of disenfranchisement of millions of black people. In 1997, the Clinton administration established the 1033 program, which expanded the transfer of military equipment to police. Today, the police in Oxford, Alabama, have an armored personnel carrier. In Lebanon, Texas, they have a tank. Now add to all of this the real war against terrorism in the wake of 9/11, and virtually every American is subject to militarized policing and disenfranchisement, particularly through the Patriot Act, an assault on civil liberties that places the U.S. under a state of permanent emergency. It gives the authorities the power to short-circuit due process, and that, if anything, describes American police behavior today. The Patriot Act has been reaffirmed by Congress under every administration. The militarized way in which the Occupy camps were dismantled showed that young middle-class white people, dissatisfied with neoliberalism, can be suppressed as easily as the black community. As a result of all this, the police, who had long resented the wall holding back their penchant to violence and suppression, which, in fact, had been the original purpose of creating the police in the first place, now had a legal and ideological justification for chipping away at it. So the ultimate contribution of Israel to U.S. policing is the concept of the security state, its own model of a militarized democracy. The security state being peddled by Israel is actually a sophisticated police state whose populace is easily manipulated by an obsession with security. It is a state driven by the logic permanent war, in which the demand for security trumps all democratic protections. Writ large, the job of the police is to police the endemic insecurities of predatory capitalism under different names: the war on drugs, the war on crime, global war on terror, securocratic wars, wars amongst the people, resource wars, counterinsurgencies, campaigns for law and order, and other euphemisms. What unites poor and racialized communities of color, working class people in general, the middle class precariat, and young people just seeking to enter the job force is that the neoliberal economy has no place for you beyond temp jobs, and that you will all face the police, capitalism's enforcer, if you threaten the system that is destroying you. That is the true and circular zero-tolerance attitude conveyed to the police by the security state. It dovetails well with the role of police throughout history, from where the violent police culture stems. If the U.S. can be prodded on its journey of becoming a security state, then Israel gains not only a major market for technologies of oppression, but a reliable ally in its own battle against Palestinian resistance. Police training and Hasbara are intimately linked. And so is Israeli training of American police. Beginning in 2002, just after 9/11, a spate of training programs emerged. The American Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, an organization that holds there is no difference between the national security interests of the United States and Israel, inaugurated its Law Enforcement Exchange Program. It partners with the Israel National Police, the Israel Ministry of Internal Security, and the Israel Security Agency, Shin Bet, and supported by the International Association of Chiefs of Police, the Major County Sheriffs Association, Major Police Chiefs Associations, and the Police Executive Research Forum, to bring to Israel for education police chiefs, sheriffs, senior law enforcement executives, state homeland security directors, state police commissioners, and federal law enforcement leadership. Over 9,500 law enforcement officers have participated in 12 conferences thus far. The knowledge gleaned from observation and training during these trips diffused Colonel Joseph Rick Fuentes, superintendent of the New Jersey State Police, prompted significant changes to the organizational structure of the New Jersey State Police and brought about the creation of the Homeland Security Branch. The Anti-Defamation League hosts an advanced training school twice a year in Washington, D.C. Its school has trained more than 1,000 U.S. law enforcement professionals representing 245 federal, state, and local agencies. The ADL runs a national counterterrorism seminar in Israel, bringing law enforcement officers from across the U.S. to Israel for a week of intense counterterrorism training, as well as connecting American law enforcement officials with the Israel National Police, the IDF, and Israel's intelligence and security services. And remember the IWI, the Israeli Uzi manufacturer. It runs a police academy in Paulden, Arizona, open to the public as well as police. And then there is the Georgia International Law Enforcement Exchange, located in the black box of a building at Georgia State in Atlanta, another major Israeli police training center. So the use of violence is not the issue in Israeli-U.S. police training. Interestingly enough, the interpersonal violence so characteristic of American police in conflict situations is lacking in Israel. Israeli police rarely handcuff people or pull their weapons, the first instinct of American cops. The violence in Israeli policing is more controlled, as it is in combat. It is less a macho kind of violence, and I think his is a key lesson Israel tries to impart to American police. Strike faster than you do. Since Israel does not have all the niceties of reading to suspects their rights or interacting with them, as we saw in the Atlanta shooting of Rashard Brooks last week, as civil rights continue to contract in the American security state, this may be ever more possible. But at the same time, Israel police do not move so suddenly from detaining to shooting. They prefer to react only through control of the situation. But when the need for shooting starts, Israeli police shift quickly to a military mode. An American security officer relates what he learned during his time in Israel with the Yaman Special Police Unit akin to a SWAT team. When it came to shooting, the major difference between Israel and American training is our philosophy on close quarter or urban combat. The biggest difference between what the Israelis did and what we Americans were trained to do was that they would oftentimes suggest going almost headlong at an enemy position while firing through the whole magazines. It usually took a matter of seconds to burn through a magazine, so fast were loads factored heavily into one's success. In training, we would advance by increments of 40 to 50 meters at a time in urban settings, all the while firing on full automatic. Back in the States, the attack is more controlled. We were taught to perhaps squeeze off rounds in 3-second bursts and then seek cover. This is not the way of Israeli security apparatus, and though it may be too bold in every circumstance, in the right scenario, I cannot think of a more effective way to gain ground. This all falls into what I call global Palestine. Don't think Israel is developing all its sophisticated weaponry, technologies of oppression, tactics of population control, and its security state framework merely to control the Palestinians. They are the guinea pigs, the occupied territory only a laboratory. Pause. That piece of Israel's military-industrial complex is geared for export, and your police are buying. Stephen Graham concludes, integration is underway between the security industrial complexes and the military industrial complexes of Israel and the United States. Even more than this, the emerging security military industrial complexes of the two nations are becoming umbilically connected, so much so that it might now be said to consider them as a single diversified transnational entity. So connect the dots. As the U.S. police become more Israelized, you, the American people, become more Palestinianized. That was an article written by Jeff Halper in Mondo Weiss. For an even deeper analysis, I urge you to read Jeff's seminal book, War Against the People. It is very relevant to what is happening on the streets of America today and offers profound, relevant research for those who are working to demilitarize the police. And now on to our feature presentation, which today is a conversation between British journalist Stephen Sacker and Hamas spokesman Ghazi Hamad, who speaks from Gaza. The conversation was recorded in March and takes place on Sacker's podcast called Hard Talk. Here is that podcast.
You're listening to a podcast from the BBC World Service. This is Hard Talk with me, Stephen Sacker. Thanks for downloading this edition of the programme. I do hope you enjoy it. Welcome to Hard Talk on the BBC World Service with me, Stephen Sacker. Viewed from the outside, there is a familiarity and circularity to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which leaves the impression that the current grim dynamic is immutable. But there just might be factors at play right now which could unsettle the status quo. Gaza this year has seen unprecedented popular protests aimed at the ruling Hamas Islamist movement for its failure to alleviate economic suffering. The leader of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, Mahmoud Abbas, is aging and his authority is waning. Meanwhile, in Washington, the Trump administration, no longer seen as an honest broker by the Palestinians, but nonetheless still central to the region's diplomacy, is preparing to launch a comprehensive peace plan based on economic rather than political foundations. My guest today, on the line from Gaza, is Hamas spokesman Ghazi Hamad. While his movement's rhetoric is unbending, do the Palestinian people long for fresh ideas? Well, Ghazi Hamad in Gaza, welcome to Hard Talk.
Thank you very much.
Let me ask you a simple question. When the people of Gaza ask you how you and the Hamas movement are going to make their lives better, what do you say?
I think we are struggling. We are working day and night in order to ease the life of people in Gaza here. But I think people, they understand very well that the reason of this crisis is occupation, is the policy of the siege, is the policy of the blockade, is the pressure on Gaza every day, because Israel looked at Gaza as a hostile region, and they tried to keep Gaza under siege, blockade, sanctions, and striking every day. I think we are trying to stop this. I think we try to do that through two tracks. First of all, reconciliation, in order to have one authority, one political regime, one system, in order also to be open to the world. And also, we are working on the track of the ceasefire agreement. I think we are trying, but I know that situation in Gaza is very critical, very difficult, But I think we have to have a final solution. You know that situation in Gaza, first of all, is not only humanitarian, it is a political. If we put end for the occupation in Gaza, I think people could breathe freedom, dignity, and respect, and they can move everywhere. They can do everything that they want.
Yeah. We understand that there are lots of things that you in Gaza are not able to deliver, and you talk about what you call the Israeli blockade, and you know that we on Hard Talk talk to very senior figures in the Israeli government about their policies toward the Gaza Strip. But I'm interested in what you can control. And the truth is that since Hamas has been in power in Gaza, which we're talking, 12, 13 years, in fact, the situation for the people has gotten so much worse. There's been a near tenfold increase in people who need to survive on food aid, for example. Unemployment is now at a record of nearly 60%. So whatever is in your gift to control, you're not controlling it effectively.
As I said before, Hamas is not so interested to keep control of Gaza. I think because of this, we went to the reconciliation since the beginning, in 2009. And we started negotiation with our brothers in Fatah. And we told him, let us now to go back to two things. First, to have a coalition, a unity government, or we can go to the elections, presidential elections or parliament elections. We know that the situation in Gaza is a big burden. It is a big challenge for us. It's not easy because Gaza is like prison. It's closed from all sides. The gates of Gaza are controlled by the occupation. Gaza is under sanctions, under the control of the occupation. So it is not easy to find a genius solution for the situation unless we put in for the occupation in Gaza.
I understand.
But as I said, we are trying, as I said.
There's no genius solution. I agree, of course, with that. But it does raise questions about the sense of your particular strategy. For example, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, Hamas's military wing, along with Islamic Jihad, took the decision to fire hundreds of rockets into Israel. Now, I'm just wondering how you can convince anybody that that is in the long-term best interests of the people of Gaza, given that it just gives license to the Israeli government to yet again impose the sort of economic blockade, maintain the blockade that you've just talked about.
Look, I think we are living in the big dilemma. We are under the occupation. And then we have to resist against this occupation because the occupation is the source of all evils and all kinds of troubles in Gaza here. And I think we are fighting the Israeli occupation in order to live in freedom and dignity. I think this is something we could not be blamed for this. This is the responsibility of the international community. They should ask Israel, you have to put in for the occupation.
You have to stop
building settlements.
Let's go through this in detail. You talk about the occupation. Of course, Gaza is not occupied. Israeli forces pulled out of Gaza many years ago. You can talk, as you do, about the economic policies
You misunderstand. You have to ask yourself, who control the borders? Who control the export and import in Gaza?
No, I understand what you are saying, there is not an Israeli military troop occupation of Gaza. There used to
be.
The Israelis pulled out.
Inside Gaza.
You and your forces continue to lob those rockets into Israel, and we had the leader of Islamic Jihad, Ziad al-Nakhale, saying just the other day that the firing of the rockets that we saw earlier this month was, to use his words, just a, quote, live fire drill for an upcoming war. And my question is, again, what sense is there in using that kind of language if you want to best represent the people of Gaza?
Look, Stephen, you have to understand, we are peaceful people. We want to live like any people in the world. We want to live in freedom. It is enough for us to live in the 70 years of occupation and dilemma and troubles every day. And I think we are looking to live like you in Britain and everywhere. And we have to stop this. And I think now Israel, please, if you make comparison with what's happening in the West Bank, there is no firing rockets, there are no fighting, there are no armed struggle in the West Bank. But in the West Bank, they're building settlements, they confiscate lands, they kill people, they put more than 405 checkpoints, they abuse the president, they now dismantle the Palestinian Authority. Do you have Israel, why you are doing this? And there are no armed strike against Israel there. I think this is the Israeli mentality that they want to punish, they want to delete the Palestinian identity. They want to destroy our future. They don't want Palestine to establish our state, our future. So I think what happened in the Gaza is the same. It's the same, the policy of the occupation. They want Gaza starving, suffering, people asking just for a piece of the bread. They want Gaza to be like this. They want Gaza to be oppressed and to be broken. And I think we, as a Palestinian faction, we want to stop this. And we want to stop this policy. We started to have a ceasefire agreement with the mediation of the Egyptians and the Qatari and United States. But till now, Israel is not committed to this agreement.
Isn't there an alternative?
No, I think they have to break.
There is an alternative possibility, Mr. Hamad, and that is that these sporadic surges of violence between you and the Israelis across this Gaza border, they suit Hamas in some ways because it distracts attention from what is clearly a growing wave of popular protest inside your communities against the rule of Hamas and the mismanagement of the economy. We saw in March unprecedented scale of street protest against Hamas, which was greeted by your security and police officers beating people up, arresting them, torturing them in detention, and you, to take attention away from that, find it very useful to launch your rockets into Israel.
Maybe you misunderstand the situation, Stephen, very well. I think we are trying here in Gaza, in order to keep the respect of people here, we try to ease the life of the people. We are struggling with other Palestinian factions, with the NGOs, with all sides, in order to make the life happy for people here. But you know that, as I said, it is not easy mission for
Ghazi
us.
Hamad,
mission for Hamas.
That simply isn't true, because you're clearly not working in cooperation with many of the NGOs in Gaza. You're, in fact, arresting members of important NGOs. During these protest, the Hamas police force not only arrested journalists, they also arrested two members of the Independent Commission for Human Rights, a Palestinian watchdog group, and they proceeded to beat them up with dozens of security officers involved. Amnesty International said the human rights violations perpetrated by Hamas against protesters, against journalists and human rights defenders have become more severe than we have seen in more than a decade.
I think if you now have around on a trip in the jails and detention centers in Gaza, you will never find a political prisoner here. You will never find a journalist in the detention center. You will not find anyone who is kept because of his political opinion now. I give you a chance now to come to Gaza and to go everywhere and to ask. I don't deny that there are some mistakes were done in the past with some people here and there, but I think we are under stronger pressure, sometimes from the occupation, sometimes from our brothers in Ramallah. They try to incite people now to go out against Hamas outside to create kind of violence here in Gaza. And I think we are trying to keep Gaza, as I said, as a calm, as a quiet area, because we want our people to live in dignity and freedom. Stephen, you can come to Gaza. You can ask all Palestinian factions and NGOs if there is just only one, a journalist or political activist in the prisons of Hamas here in Gaza.
I don't know if you use social media, Ghazi Hamad, but have you seen the widely circulated videos of the protesters in Gaza saying things like, and I'm quoting one woman that I've seen on video, saying, "The sons of Hamas leaders have houses, they have jeeps and big cars, they can get married, it's no problem for them, while ordinary people here have nothing, not even a piece of bread." When you see those sorts of videos on social media, how do you respond to them?
I don't think that you should now accept everything in the social media.
I agree with you. I'm just suggesting there is a wave of opinion in the communities inside Gaza which is problematic for you and your leadership.
I hope that you can come to Gaza and sit with people of different factions. I don't deny that there are some people who criticize Hamas. There are some people, they don't like Hamas, that's right. But now, if you come to Gaza, there is some kind of democratic elections here in Gaza, in the universities. We ask the Palestinian faction to share with us in order to rule the Gaza Strip here. We sit many times with the Palestinian NGOs here in Gaza in order to listen to them. If they have violation, criticism against Hamas here, I think we are open. We try to correct and we try to do everything good for people here. We are not angels. I don't say that we don't make mistakes. But in general, I think we are doing very hard in order to keep Gaza calm and quiet. We try to avoid any kind of political arrest or closing the mouths of people or to stop the people talking there or to express their opinions. I think many articles are written here in Gaza and they're criticizing Hamas. They're speaking very sharply, very loudly, and no one stopped them.
Mm. You gave access to a BBC documentary team last year to look at how one particular day in the March of Return went. It was a day, I believe, in May 2018, May 14th, and the BBC film crew showed Palestinians, including women, saying that they were being organised. We line up like a human shield so that the men can advance further. It did seem to portray a very careful coordination by Hamas security forces of this march of return. And I just want to know whether in the future, from now on, whether Hamas is going to continue to use the march of the return in the way it appears to have used it in the past.
Look, sometimes when we adopt the military resistance, they say Hamas is a terrorist organization. And we will now try to go to the peaceful means. They said this is also a terrorism against Israel. And I think when people, they went to the borders and they're just peaceful people. They don't have guns. They have, don't have even stones. They don't have grenades. They have nothing. Just people of protest in order to get the attention of the world that there is a crisis in Gaza, that people, they deserve a state, people deserve dignity. And you know, since the beginning of this peaceful march, since 2018, we have about 300 people were killed.
Indeed.
Most of them are children, most people are innocent people, and most of them are women, and no one account Israel or stop them.
We
have about 30,000 people were injured. We try to keep it as peaceful because it is our slogan in order to keep this march as a peaceful march. It is not a military march.
So you will never find anyone, he
is a military.
Okay. So we challenge the Israelis on their use of lethal force. Believe me, ministers have been challenged many times on this program. But when Palestinians amongst the protesters say things like this, quote, some of us distracted the Israelis with stones and Molotov cocktails before an attempt was made to cut the border fence. Are you telling me that Hamas wasn't aware of that? It seems it was very carefully organized under Hamas's security control.
Look, Stephen, we don't want anyone to be injured. We don't want anyone to be killed. I think it is our job. We try to prevent people from being killed. It is our job. It's our people. We don't want to expose them to killing by the Israeli sniper.
If you line up women and children like a human shield so the men can advance further, that, to me, is the very opposite of safeguarding the safety of your civilian population.
We want to prevent people to be killed. So, and now we have sometimes kind of negotiation and talks through the Egyptian mediation in order to have a ceasefire agreement. So I think we don't want people or more people to be killed or more people to be injured. But you know, you have to understand now, the Israeli sniper in the borders, they are sitting, they are comfortable, they use guns, they kill people, they shoot people in their head, in their abdomen, in their knees. And as I said, we have about more than 3,000-4,000 people are handcuffed now, people. In addition to that, about more than 20,000 people. We want Israel to stop shooting people or to use live ammunition against people because it is a peaceful march. But I'm so astonished because the international community is keeping silent. Sometimes they blame Hamas for firing rockets, but they don't also blame Israel for killing the innocent people in the borders, including children and women.
Isn't the truth, Ghazi Hamad, that Hamas has been in power in Gaza for an awful long time? Benjamin Netanyahu has been in power for an awful long time in Israel and, of course, has just won another election. And the truth is, it suits both you in Hamas and Netanyahu to have the other as the reliable enemy. There is some sort of strange symbiotic relationship which leaves both of you actually satisfied with the status quo because it allows you to perpetuate your own power.
No, I think there is a big difference. I think, as I said, we want to put end for the occupation. Netanyahu is not so interested now to end the problems of Gaza. He tried with the different choices. He tried through military strikes against Gaza. He threw the collective sanctions, the military strikes against, throw the policy of a blockade. But I think he failed. Now Gaza is like a bone in his throat. He could not swallow it. He could not throw it outside. So I think Israel should understand that they could not break the bones.
Sorry, Ghazi Hamad, I don't mean to interrupt too much, but if I may say so, surely the truth is the very opposite, that Netanyahu uses the rhetoric of you and your leadership in Hamas as a reason why he will not engage in any land for peace deal, will not talk about a two-state solution, because he quotes leaders like Fatih Hamad of Hamas, who said just the other day on the commemoration of the day that you call the al-Nakba, the catastrophe of 1948, Fatih Hamad said this. He said that there will be victory, there will be an uprooting of the Zionist enemy from our land. And to Israel's leaders, he said, go away, the day of your slaughter and elimination is nearing. You have no place in Jerusalem, Haifa, and Jaffa.
Look, I don't take care about what Netanyahu says. Netanyahu could lie for his people. He could lie for the international community. I think he is full of lies and fabricated sayings.
But I'm asking you, whether the language I've just quoted from Fatih Hamad is useful, interests of the people of Gaza? Yes or no?
Look, I think Hamas said many times that we accept Palestinian state and 67 borders. But I think we are not ready to recognize the right of Israel. Because I think Israel is a state of the occupation. I think you should not blame the Palestinians. You should blame the occupation and Israel. Because Israel all the time is supplying the occupation, either in West Bank, in the Gaza. They are supplying, they're supporting the killing of the Palestinian people. So I think maybe some people are very angry. Arab people upset. Now, if you look to the other side, to the Fatah and the President Abbas, he spent 25, 27 years in peaceful talks and negotiation with Israel, but he got nothing. He got big zero. He got more settlements, more confiscation of lands, more isolation in West Bank. We got nothing. So what's the choice is left for the Palestinians? Let us now, just people, they want the Palestinians to be polite and just to flow flowers for the Israeli occupation forces, and just to keep silent.
Well,
I think it is not logic. It is not fair. We have to struggle against the occupation.
Right. No one would argue that the last 70 years have worked out very well for the Palestinians, so maybe it's time for fresh thinking. Donald Trump and his team apparently are going to launch their so-called deal of the century, new plan for Israeli-Palestinian peace in June. It seems their focus will all be on economic incentives, not major political initiatives, but economic incentives to get tens of billions of dollars into the Palestinian communities if they're prepared to make a peace, albeit with difficult decisions. Are you prepared to listen to the Trump deal?
Look, I think Stubbit is he's the best Stubbit president in the world. I think he's wasting time because for two things. Now, no one is convinced that Trump is doing the right. He has no plan in his mind. I think he understands that he's an empire of the world. He could change everything. He could change. Now, he gave Israel a Jerusalem. He gave him a Golan Heights. Now, I think he's ready to give him Iraq and Qatar and Oman and all the Middle East. I think he thinks that he could buy his pencil. He could give Israel everything. I think that the deal of the century will not be achieved, will not be done, because all Palestinians, either in the left or the other side, they're against this. And I think the Arabic world, the Muslim world, they're against the plan of the deal of the century. So I think he will fail. And I assure that today or tomorrow, Trump, he will not able to do anything to convince the Palestinians or the Arabs to accept his plan. So I think he should put it aside and think with something else.
And do you think that kind of rejectionism, before you've even heard what the plan is truly in the interests of the people of Gaza, who, as we've said from the beginning of this interview, are suffering the most terrible economic deprivations right now?
No, I think we don't just reject, because I think according to 70 years, no one gave us a final solution, Stephen. No one gives the Palestinians a positive initiatives. I think they are lying and lying, including Europe, including the United States, including the international community. They are just lying. They give just people, the Palestinian people, and tranquilizers, try to tell him that you have to wait the American elections, the Israel elections, you have to wait for the French initiatives, the Britain initiatives. I think we wasted 70 years and we are still living under the occupation. We are losing everything. So I think now this, the economic solution is not a solution. It is not a solution. We as a Palestinians, we are looking for a political solution which says, frankly, that end of the occupation, the Palestinians deserve a state, we have to establish our state, the occupation is over. This is our plan. But you should not deceive us with some piece of bread, with some money, with some financial solution. I think we are not poor people for money. We are poor just for freedom.
Ghazi Hamad, we have to end there, but I thank you very much for joining me from Gaza.
You have been listening to a conversation between British journalist Stephen Sacker and Hamas spokesman Ghazi Hamad, speaking from Gaza on the podcast Hard Talk. Before we go, we just want to take a moment to reflect on this historic moment, when white eyes are finally beginning to focus on systematic, chronic suppression of black people through their policing. Thanks to iPhone photos, the historic lying of police in their reports concerning interactions with the black community are finally coming to light, and unwarranted police violence exposed. What is encouraging is how the black community is linking their suppression to that of the Israeli military against the Palestinian people. Just this week, there was another execution of an unarmed Palestinian man at an Israeli checkpoint. This time, the cousin of Rutgers professor Nora Arakat, who has often appeared on This Week in Palestine. We cannot let this historic moment pass with just demonstrations and speeches. We need to change the structure of institutions that are charged with keeping us safe and secure. And we in the Palestinian rights movement need to draw the parallels of the militarized police violence in the United States to that of the militarized violence that Israel is perpetrating against Palestinians. This is our moment. Okay, we've made it through another broadcast of This Week in Palestine. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. If you miss a program, you will be able to find it in all our past broadcasts on our permanent archive at truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org. Then click on This Week in Palestine Archives. It is all there due to the diligence of our colleague Stan Robinson. Thanks for joining us this morning, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts signing off until next week, when we will do it all again.